And in the spirit of truth and reconciliation, I am here this morning to share my truth. Can I do that? I'm asking for your permission to be a little bit vulnerable this morning. Can I share with you my truth? Nine. I would be 9 years old the first time I would be called a nigger. N-I-G-G-E-R. It would be in a playground. And it would not be by the schoolyard bully. It would be by a child that I would have otherwise considered to be my friend. Kids that I would have played road hockey with, kids that I would have grown up with and spent times at their house, that first word, it hit me. It would be the first time I would get into my first fist fight. It would be the first time I would suffer a suspension. For the weight of the policies of the time would look at my violence as being more egregious than the violence of the racist attack in which I experienced in the schoolyard. Fourth grade would also be the time where I was selected from amongst all the students in my school to represent Ridgemount Elementary at the International Day of the Child. I would convene in a facility much like this with thousands of kids from across the city. Having no clue why I was there, I would see on stage all these dignitaries. And one man would catch my eye. This man was larger than life. He was dignified, 6'4", dressed so well, so eloquent. I would ask my mother, "Who is that man?" She would tell me, "Son, that is the Honorable Lincoln Alexander." And I would say, "Mom, what does he do?" And she would tell me that he is a politician. So I knew in fourth grade that that is what I would become. Mostly because I had never seen a black man so powerful and dignified, so elevated on his stage. I had never seen our people reflected in that way. 12. I would be 12 years old, the first time I would come face to face with neo-Nazis in my city. Again, with that word, nigger. N-I-G-G-E-R. I can remember it like it was yesterday. A boy walking through the mall with his family. Two men, both grown, following behind me. I can remember exactly what they looked like. Bald head, bomber jacket, white shirt, red suspenders, blue jeans, Doc Martens, white laces. They would follow me through the mall, whispering the most hateful and vitriolic words. My brother, who's 16 at the time, would turn around and see what was happening to his younger brother. He would intervene, and for his efforts, he would be jumped by these two neo-Nazis. I can remember the embarrassment and the pain of seeing my brother physically assaulted by these people, surpassed only by the outrage of seeing the hundreds of people, or at least what felt like hundreds of people, who would stand and congregate and do nothing. These lessons early in my life would teach me two things. That as a 9-year-old, my fight would be bigger than my flight. And as a 12-year-old, my older brother taught me that the temporary pain of stepping in to these types of confrontations were less important than the lifetime of shame of doing absolutely nothing. I would be 14 when my mother would explain to me why she wasn't paid the same as her male counterparts. Equalizations as a public sector worker for the federal government. I would be 16 when I would accompany my father and OSSTF in Hamilton for the Days of Action to fight Harris. How many people in this room attended those Days of Action? You will remember what the collective power was like as 100,000 people took the streets. to defend our public sector services, to defend the very cultures and values that we hold so near and dear to our hearts in Ontario. I would also be 16 when I would meet Mr. George, an old school history teacher who used to wear these polyester pants and these short sleeve banker shirts. Mr. George would have a bookcase in the back of his classroom. And he would tell me, "Matthew, anytime you want to grab a book and do a book report, I'll give you bonus marks." All those books happened to be political philosophy books. Books that would open my mind as a young urban kid to things that I had never dreamed possible. I would read every book that I could, and he would give me every bonus mark that he could, because he knew that given the opportunity, I might be able to reach my potential. I would be remiss to say that for every Mr. George, there was somebody telling me that I would never amount to anything. But it's the Mr. George that I remember and honor today here. I would be 21 when a professor would tell me maybe university wasn't for me. I would be 22 when I would return back to my city. A city in Hamilton, which you will know in the 90s, I had two choices for university. I was either going to go to UBC or Acadia. I was going to get as far away from the suffering in my city as I possibly can. Hands up if you've driven over the Skyway Bridge. You will have witnessed the North End industrial legacy of my city. You will know that that neighborhood is my ward, and my Ward 3 is the Hamilton what Hamilton is to the rest of the country. A place where in the 60s and 70s, the working class in the steel industries built this country through the production of steel that would end up in our manufacturing. You will know that in the 80s and 90s, under policies like NAFTA, we would see our jobs shipped away. We would see people move on to try to find other employment. You see, I think that I too am to Hamilton what Hamilton is to the rest of the country. My grandfather came to the city looking for a good job to be able to take care of his family, pay the bills. My father would follow him and become an iron worker there and later a teacher in shop. But my story doesn't start there. You see, when I was 9 years old, I would have told you that in those experiences, I would go and look for who I was, for who my people were, feeling isolated from my peer group. And at that time as a child, I would have read the history books, and the history books would have said that in this context, you are the son of freed slaves. Because 45 minutes from Hamilton, the home of the Black Moses, Harriet Tubman. You see, my people would have walked from Maryland. They would have followed the footpaths of the Underground Railroad. They would have followed the North Star to freedom. And as a man who began to find knowledge of self, I would know that I was not the son of runaway slaves. I was the son of freedom seekers. And for those of you who have heard me speak before, you will know that I would talk about the allies along the way, the people who made it possible for people from my family to be able to make it here, to sacrifice everything. Those were abolitionists. Those were abolitionist times. And we can't rest on this idea that somehow history is linear. No, it is not linear. We have freedom seekers showing up at our borders in Quebec today. We have freedom seekers who will risk their lives through the cold to get here tomorrow. So when we talk about truth, we have to sit in the uncomfortable truth of not just our past. We have to reconcile our present values with today. And given the onslaught that was described by your president that is felt by the children in your classrooms, we know that the future can be grim. And I think about the spirit of my people. I am grateful for their strength, It is through the spirit of my people that I'm able to be here today to stand before you as an organizer, somebody from the grassroots, somebody who at every step along the way will challenge and disrupt power and try to redistribute it to build it with people and not centralize it in the very small percentage of elites who make decisions on behalf of people in this country that affect outcomes that they have no idea about. You talk about white privilege, there's class privilege, there's all types of privileges, barriers that are put in front of people. And so when I think about my people on that footpath, when I think about the courage in the face of adversity that they had to face, I ask myself, what am I willing to sacrifice? Who am I willing to reach out to? Who in this room is willing to become an abolitionist? To abolish all the isms and ills that face our society? Who among us today has the courage to face the adversity? Leadership is about recognizing the uncertainty in these times and moving ahead anyways. Because these systems of chaos are meant to provide a paralysis, a powerlessness, a disenfranchisement where you feel like you have no effective change. I don't care if there is 40 people in this room, 400 or 4,000, I would start with you here today and I would walk that road and path ahead. Now this might surprise you. The path ahead is possible by a model that you hear a lot about. Now stay with me. Who here has heard of the P3 model? Hands up. I am a strong believer in the P3 model. Did I hear someone strip their teeth? Was there a side eye? What's the P3 model? No, it is not public-private partnerships. I caught the alliterations. I was inspired by President Lachique with the alliterations. I'm talking about people-powered partnerships. I'm talking about a pedagogy of progressive policy change. Are the opportunities in front of us to reach out and build coalitions across unlikely actors to pull them together? That is the only way that we are going to be able to react to things like Bill 57, which just passed, an omnibus bill. Then unless you have the time to go through the 800-page report and pick out what those words mean and how it's going to affect the outcomes of our communities, you won't know what's happening. In the left, we have largely been reactionary, and it's not our fault. We largely move to mobilize before we've organized. Is that fair? Right? I have a framework for organizing, and I've shared it before. I talk about getting some. You say, well, what's that mean, getting some? There's a policy for that. I'm talking about getting some power. I'm talking about getting some equality. I'm talking about getting some justice. And getting some, in the context of today, is broken down by the following. First, we must socialize. I firmly believe that unless we get familiar, and it doesn't matter whether it's in your local, it doesn't matter if it's ETT or EDFO or the OFL, if you're not getting familiar with people, if you're not understanding what makes them tick as humans and where you can find that common ground, then by the time you go to mobilize, you're going to find the disruptions inside your own movements. The cannibalization of the left. We tend to eat our own when we're trying to move forward. The Hunger Games of taking 47 seats and whittling them down to 25 was a direct attempt to undermine the incredible work of Progress Toronto. They are banking that we will turn on ourselves. They are banking that you will put your own individual self-interests above the self-interest of the collective. That is their model. It's not a new model. We need to persuade people What we have in this room, what you have in ETT, are systems of education, models of pedagogy that can reach out into our communities. When you go home after work, yes, you're an educator, but not just in the classroom. You're an educator in your community. You're an educator in your faith groups. You're an educator in your cultural groups. You have the skill sets in this room to disrupt the ruling class. Politicians, by their very nature, tend to be reluctant to lead. Know this, that in the timeline in the history of civil rights, young people have been present, students have been present, women have been present, LGBTQ communities have been present, leading the way, blazing the pathway for everybody to follow. Because there will be people who will say, we have to go slow. We have to be incremental. Do you know what I call those people? I call them liberals. Let me be very clear about something. Doug Ford is a symptom. Doug Ford is not the reason why I have people living in tents a kilometer away from City Hall while simultaneously we do $1 billion a year in building. Doug Ford is not the reason why our schools have 30 years of deferred maintenance, where we have windows that are not keeping the cold out or the heat in, where we have school children in our city who have to wear jackets to go to class, where we have children who are going to school hungry. You teach them, you know that if they can't read by third grade, the likelihood of them graduating is greatly reduced. You know that if they go to school hungry, they're not going to be reading at third grade by the third grade level. You know that if they don't have a place to live, if they're living in a precarious family, the chances of them having outcomes in the education system are next to none. If they don't have an advocate in their corner fighting for them, you know the likelihood of their failure is there. That's why the leadership must come from the rank and file. That's why in this province, when you talk about Doug Ford, when you hear things like the official opposition, when you hear things like the people, remember this, we are the people, we are the official opposition. And when it comes to the collective days of action, and mark my words, they will come. This government will only speak one language, and that's a language of power. And the only way that working class people can show their power is not at a $1,000 a table backroom business deal. It's in the streets. It's going back to our roots of abolitionism. It's being willing to sacrifice for ourselves and our comfort. And hey, listen, my father and his wife are retired teachers. They're incredible. I owe a debt of gratitude to these unions that made it possible for me growing up. But let's say, yeah. But let's not kid ourselves. We have fallen asleep under the last 20 years of liberalism.
Yes.
And if that feels uncomfortable for you, I want you to reflect on why. Why is it on the end of a 20-year term would they only start to talk about class issues? Why is it they'd only take the suppressed wages of $11 and bump it to $14? Why is it that people on Ontario Works are making less now than they did under Harris? Why is it that people on ODSP can't find adequate housing? Why do we have people living in tents? Those are liberal policies. They might make us feel good, but if you look at the way people are living and the way that I have when I've reached out into my community and I've seen it, I've been ashamed to be Canadian. The good news is this, it doesn't have to be this way. The good news is this, with 40, 400, or 4,000 people from this union, we can take it to the streets. We can reach out into our community and we can bring people in. You take a look around this room right now. Take a look. Look to the back. Look to the left and the right. Every seat is a potential. Every empty chair is an opportunity. That's my call to action today. You want to have courage in the face of adversity? Let's start today. Let's start for the things that you fought for as a union and expand it out there with 15 in fairness. Let's fight for working class people. Let's fight for our kids and our seniors. That's what I'm talking about. That's why I'm here today. And that's why anytime you call me, I'll be there. In my introduction, you heard about some things, right? Like, I don't want to just be platitude. Let's learn, because there's only about 5 people signed up for my workshop. So I'm going to give you the Coles notes right now. Don't think that doesn't hurt my feelings. Maybe I gave you something to think about. Let's talk quickly about power. I come from the grassroots. I came back to my city at a time when I didn't think there was opportunity. I created my own opportunity. I started a business. I got out there. I was a personal trainer. I joke about it because I'm working on my dad body. But at the time, I owned a gym. And I would work with people on their individual fitness. I would set goals. I would disrupt their behavior. And I would try to make change. And then I realized that game wasn't big enough. And I went to team training. And I spent 10 years on the Six Nations territory working with that community in inner city Hamilton, trying to provide barrier-free fitness. From that, I recognized there was a bigger game and community development. That if I could take the systems and principles that I had learned from fitness, from the psychology and the sociology of why we are the way we are, and apply it to the broader community, then the things that I was observing that just weren't right, we could perhaps make change on. For 4 years, I would be accused of being an activist in my city council. He's an activist. And I would reply, what's the opposite of an activist? Somebody who sees a problem and does nothing? Damn right I'm an activist. What does that make you? We're here to get it done. So what's your theory of change? How are you going to go back to your communities and, I call it, cross the river, cross over that delta, get to outcomes and impacts where you reach into somebody's heart and you touch their soul? You inspire kids to be empathic. You inspire kids to be by nature loving and caring and kind. You have in your hands the future. You have it every day. No pressure. What are you going to do with it? So when I went to council, I came straight from a campaign. We had this thing when Dalton McGuinty prorogued. It was called the Modernization Plan for the OLG, the Casino Plan. Do you remember what that was? When they had this great idea that they were going to modernize casinos by taking them away from the suburbs and the rural areas where the racetracks were and plopping them down in the inner city. They did that at the exact same time. I was a board member of the Hamilton Community Foundation. We had just done this study. It was called Vital Signs. Vital Signs identified code red neighborhoods in our community. What does that look like? Out of 11 code red neighborhoods, my neighborhood had 4. Those are kids going to school hungry. That's a 61-year life expectancy. 61-year life expectancy. I looked at that and I said, these guys, that's predatory. They know that proximity and gambling creates problem gambling. They know that they're getting 20% of the revenue from 2% of the population from 2 in the morning to 6 at night. Pick up the paper and see, you know, the treasurer of the local church choir stealing money to go gamble. Look at the liberal scandals. This is a big deal. They know the math, but they wanted to soak our community with a regressive taxation on low-income people. And we said, hell no. You know what they told me? You've heard this before. You know what they said? It's a done deal, kid. Forget it. We were going up against Paul Godfrey, Rod Phillips, our local families. If you're from Hamilton, you know what that means. We were going up against the Hard Rock Casino, billion-dollar industry. Who are you, some small business entrepreneur, a group of like North End activists and you know, Dutch Reform horse farmers and you know, some academics? Who are you to stop $200 million of development? I said, we're Hamiltonians. So we organized and we built coalitions with people we might not otherwise agreed on with different issues, but we came together for this one. And we fought tooth and nail. We begged our elected officials to do the right thing. We socialized people on the issues. We organized people, and then we mobilized to put pressure on politicians to push for progressive policy change. We did that and we won. We won. And what that taught us, what that taught us is that when the citizenry, nah, scrap that, the residentry, because I don't care where you're born and what citizenship you got. If you're living in a city, damn it, you should be able to vote. You should be able to run for office. You should be able to do all that stuff at the municipal level. We recognize that we could champion progressive policies and move at a breakneck speed. Let Doug Ford teach us this one lesson, that you could be radical in your change, that you don't have to worry about necessarily what the think tanks are thinking or what the polls are saying or what the op-eds are writing. That if we collectively get our stuff together now, much like Progress Toronto did 4 years ago, and we organize right now, 2022 is right around the corner. If we organize for Ontario, if we go door to door, street to street, neighborhood to neighborhood, we will topple this government. I have more of the secret sauce of organizing in my workshop, if y'all would like to attend later on, as a call to action. But the best news of the day is that we don't have to wait to 2022. The best news of the day, that the challenges that I identified with liberalism, neoliberalism, the privatization, the crony corporatism, we're going to face that fight next year. We're going to face that fight in 2019, where you have the opportunity to be involved, to go shoulder to shoulder with riding associations, to support incredible candidates. And here's the deal. I'll take this point of personal privilege. It's not good enough, like I experienced. It's not good enough to go to somebody after they've been nominated and ask them if they align with your values by signing a petition or a pledge or doing a hashtag. What we need to do is we need to do what Felicia did. We need to become candidates. We need to become candidates. We need to bring to the table the working class values of this province and this country and our communities. And there's no secret sauce to that. There's no mythology about being a candidate. You have to be willing to be vulnerable and share your compelling alternative for the future of this country. And I'll take a point of political privilege, that I, like many of you, I was cynical. I didn't see my values reflected in the parties or the politicians. I ran as an independent. In fact, I ran against NDP candidates. I ran against people who told me, you know what, kid, you should probably go run and be a school board trustee, or maybe you should go and be this guy's like executive assistant before you take a shot at the title. I said, nah, my time is now. And when I took on the pernicious, racist practice of racial profiling, it's not my opinion, these are statistics. The math is clear. The targeting of young black males indiscriminately and arbitrarily has no place in a free and democratic society. And when I did that, I was lonely. I looked for other leadership. I said, where are they? I reached out to my brother Muhammad Sally in London. We said, this is not just a Toronto experience. This is an experience that happens with racialized, indigenous, and low-income people across the province. So when you talk about the bell tolls, who answered the call? Well, I can tell you this, that as a cynical, independent, a bit of a maverick, I had the privilege of talking in an audience much like this. It was the African Legal Clinic. And a young MPP, a deputy leader named Jagmeet Singh, answered the call. And he spoke truth to power, because he understood from lived experience what it was like to be humiliated and dehumanized. and made to feel like you have to question your own existence in the community. And when I heard this man speak, and then when I subsequently watched him during his leadership race, that was my call to action, to get off the sidelines and be a part of this values conversation, this country. That's why I'm here today. That's why I'm honored to share the stage with Farah Khan and Jugmeet Singh and your incredible organization. And that's why y'all should come check my workshop after this. Thank you very much.
My name is